Hello, and welcome to the Skeleton Factory Podcast, episode 60. This is your host, Adam, coming to you from Austin, Texas. And today, I'll be taking a look at two films. The first is The Boys Next Door from 1985. And the second is an Austrian film called Angst from 1983. Both of these films, what do they have in common? Well, they're about people who go on a rampage, go on a crime-filled rampage, home invasions, theft, murder, the list goes on, over very short periods of time. So it just sort of adds to the chaos of the story. So let's jump right into it, shall we? The Boys Next Door from 1985, directed by Penelope Spears. From Roger Corman's New World Pictures. I'm a big fan of New World Pictures. The list of amazing films they produce is staggering. They did Hellraiser 1 and 2. They did The Stuff, Chud, Suburbia, which was directed by Penelope Spears. The Initiation, which I'm a big fan of. You know, we have Daphne Zuniga. Princess Vespa is in The Initiation. And sort of the finale takes place in a mall. I mean, it's very much the most 80s thing ever. Slumber Party Massacre, another New World Pictures film. Humanoids from the Deep. Love Humanoids from the Deep. Shogun Assassin. Rock and Roll High School, for all you Ramones fans. And even New World Pictures even had a hand in The Punisher motion picture. The real Punisher. The Dolph Lundgren Punisher. And the list goes on. But you can also add to that list The Boys Next Door. The Boys Next Door is if Beavis and Butthead was a serious crime drama about two high school rejects that head out west to Los Angeles and go on a violent rampage. It stars Charlie Sheen as Bo and Maxwell Caulfield as Roy. If you're not sure who Maxwell Caulfield is, you'll remember him from Empire Records, the character of Rex Manning. And this past April, April 8th to be exact, is Rex Manning Day, which was a celebration that took place inside of the world of Empire Records, Rex Manning Day. So yeah, Charlie Sheen and Rex Manning are the stars of this film, but they're very young in this. I believe Charlie Sheen was 18 and Maxwell Caulfield was a little older. I think he was 23. So what is The Boys Next Door about? It's about the misery of being an outsider in a small town, doomed to work in some factory for the rest of your life. No college on the horizon. No girlfriends. No friends in general. Just an awful factory job waiting for them on Monday morning. Bo and Roy, after school is let out, Bo and Roy go and crash a party. They make a complete spectacle of themselves. And Roy jumps into the pool, and he takes a piss in the pool. You know this by the kid whose house it is yells at Roy, "Don't you pee in the pool. My dad put a chemical in there that'll turn the water purple if you pee in the pool." Just then, you see a Roy, after he did a swan dive into the pool, sort of basking and all the eyes being on him, you see this growing purple cloud surrounding him in the water. It's very funny. It's one of the few moments of humor in the movie. The old don't pee in the pool or it'll change the color of the water. We all know about this. It's a chemical dye that when urine is introduced to it will cause swimming pool water or hot tub or jacuzzi water to change color around the person who's doing the peeing. If you do know about this, it's because, well, your parents lied to you. There is no anti-piss pool chemical that exists. Okay? I know this may be a shock to some of you. It's an old wives' tale that goes back as far as the 1930s. And every couple of decades, the myth gets dug up again to scare kids. It's like vote-by-mail ballot drop-off boxes being safe and reliable. It's a myth, and it's not real. But I do like that it was, you know, depicted in the movie just to kind of demonstrate that Bo and Roy are, they're assholes. So they leave the party and decide, hey, you know, let's get out of town for the weekend. Let's head out to Los Angeles for a weekend of fun and excitement. So once they get to Los Angeles, they stop for gas. And while pumping gas, they think that the gas station attendant ripped them off. It was a whole thing where they gave the gas station guy $2. So they're pumping the gas and it stops at $2. And Roy's like, well, what the hell? We put in $6. And then Charlie Sheen, Bo had the nerve to say, hey, Roy, this camel jockey is trying to rip us off. And the gas station attendant guy's like, holds up the $2. He's like, dude, you gave me $2. You didn't give me $6. You paid for $2. So after this, Roy immediately beats the poor guy half to death with a crowbar. Not only a crowbar, but with the actual gas pump. The thing you pump your gas with that's on the flexible tube. Beating the guy with a crowbar wasn't enough. He had to like beat this guy with the actual gas pump. And then just left him there for dead. They jump in the car and they take off. Now, this scene is especially jarring, even by today's standards. So, it's the first look into, in particular, Roy's pent-up rage and disregard for other humans. The next day, on a stroll down the Venice Beach boardwalk, while having some beers, Roy takes his empty beer bottle and hurls the empty bottle into a crowd of people, hitting some poor old lady who's accosting some nice young folks about smoking the pot, and the bottle like bounces off her head and she starts bleeding. And Bo and Roy, they decide like, yeah, we should probably get out of here, you know. So they decide to leave, and they leave the scene, but once they get to their car, they're swarmed by a group of bikini-clad stunt women, basically, who attack Roy's car, screaming at him to, hey, you better take that old lady to the hospital, and Bo and Roy realize, like, we need to get the hell out of here because they're hitting the car and whatnot. So they go to take off, and one of the ladies jumps onto the hood, and Roy takes off anyways with this woman on the hood. Roy eventually flings her off the car by slamming on the brakes, pulling it in reverse, and going backwards, and she just rolls off the hood. So, already, as soon as they get into LA, it's chaos with these two. So then we have this, scene where the two of them go over to the La Brea tar pits, and they have this conversation about Bo wishes that they can just have one day where they can just go crazy and do whatever they want. And here's that clip now.
Stupid Dax, really get off calling us fags.
I mean, wouldn't it be great if the government declared like an official caveman day? I mean, you could just knock girls over the head, drag them back to your house, and completely drill their socks off. You could do anything. You could throw rocks at people, run around naked, take a shit in the middle of the street. Just be totally pre-a-fucking-story.
Better than Valentine's Day.
All right, listen. We're going to go back to the motel, take a shower, eat someplace nice, like Sizzler, and then it's caveman day. What do you say?
So by this point, the cops are on to Bo and Roy. The lead detective is the character of Detective Mark Woods, who's played by Christopher McDonald, who you will know as Shooter McGavin from Happy Gilmore, the Adam Sandler golf movie. Everyone knows Christopher McDonald. He's great. So he's sort of the lead detective in this, but he plays it totally straight. And he's the one that's ultimately going to be the one tracking these guys down. So for the sake of not glorifying the horrific scenes and making them look too cool, because they are stylized and they have like rockin' music over these scenes, and I mean, the trail of damage these two guys do is pretty bad, and they're both pretty dumb. So keep that in mind. And that's something that Penelope Spears in the commentary track for this, she does a great commentary track with her and Maxwell Caulfield. And she said that because at this point in her career, like the Boys Next Door almost comes off like, I don't know, like almost like some type of grindhouse exploitation type of film. Like it's kind of hyper violent. It's very 80s in terms of its gratuitous kind of sexual rock and roll violent nature. But she said that, you know, she doesn't regret making the movie, but it's not some place that she would want to revisit. It's not the type of movie that she would want to do now at this point in her career. Because it's understandable, you know, especially after, she did Black Sheep with Chris Farley, and she did Wayne's World. She really found her niche in doing like comedy, like really relatable, good comedies, and doing these sort of kind of bleak, violent movies. I think at some point wasn't really her thing. After this, the boys graduate to murder pretty quickly. They go from assault. They stole gas from the gas station also. They just like filled up their tank and took it. So they basically rob the gas station. They fucking assault an old woman. They assault the bikini clad ladies at the beach. Oh, there goes the police now. Maybe they're going to arrest Charlie Sheen. Anyway, so, but things escalate very quickly, and these two go from just simple assaults and thefts to just straight up murder. So they're cruising the city, and they wander into a gay bar, and befriend one of its patrons, the character of Chris, who's just some dude who's like hanging out at this gay bar. And they convince Chris to take them home with him. It's pretty much they walked into the gay bar and they didn't realize they were in a gay bar. It's another one of those scenes where these two guys are small town, middle of the road, naive, fucking white kids. You know, Penelope Spears didn't want to make them. She made it a point to not make them look like punk rocker guys or metalhead dudes or skater guys or something. Like, wanted them to be as sort of generic looking, like small town dudes as humanly possible, because that's really who kind of commits the type of crimes that Bo and Roy do in real life. It's just kind of like random kids who lose their shit and lash out at the world. And I think she did that was a really smart choice. It's not like the film Class of 1984 or something, where it's like these kind of Hollywood looking 80s punk rockers who are like, you know, snarling and have switchblades and whatever. Like, that's just like a costume to make them seem more evil. But it's the fact that Bo and Roy look so normal that I think really drives the point home that, like, a lot of, especially serial murder, and everyone knows this, it's typically done by very average, normal looking people. So Roy gets a case of I don't want to be in a gay bar. And he's basically like, him and Bo are like, okay, dude, let's get out of here. And Chris is like, well, where do you want to go? And he's like, anywhere. Let's go to your place. Now, as they're walking out, kind of Bo looks at Roy and kind of mouths the words like, dude, he's a fag. And Roy's like, yeah, I know. Which is like, oh no. So, you know, Roy has bad intentions. He's setting up this poor Chris guy. So once they are comfortably inside of Chris's apartment, it's not long before Roy jumps on Chris, first trying to choke him, then resorting to just a harsh beating, smashing a lamp on his head and punching him and kicking him and throwing him around the room, throwing him through a table, finally ending with Bo and Roy finding Chris's revolver that he keeps in a drawer in his coffee table. And Roy takes the gun from Bo and shoots and kills Chris. And it's horrifying. It's terrible. And then once that's done, they leave. And it's not even like they robbed the place. Like, they just, Roy wanted to get this guy alone and just kill him. So now they have their first official murder victim, and they have this guy's gun. So they get in their car and take off. So then a young couple they follow home from a local arcade are next. They're next victims. They end up getting shot dead while sitting in their convertible in their driveway. Basically, they go to, Bo and Roy go to this arcade called Westworld, and Bo's kind of hitting on this girl, but the girl has a boyfriend, and, you know, Roy sees the opportunity of like, oh, you know, fuck that girl, let's just follow her and her date home and murder them. Again, he waited for the right moment where they were alone, there was no one around, and he knew that they'd be easy victims. So once Roy gets a taste of murder, now it's like the killing spree is now beginning. Then Last one, I swear. At another bar, not a gay one this time, Bo and Roy go into this bar, and Bo is immediately giving those Charlie Sheen fucking come fuck me tiger blood eyes at the character of Angie. Angie's just some local dive bar floozy who sort of takes mercy on Bo and Roy after the two of them get booted out of the bar for not having ID. So she invites them over to her apartment. Of course, she lives alone. So after they get to her place, they have some drinks. Bo and Angie play a flirty game of quarters, which quickly escalates to Bo and Angie going from kind of making out, kind of first base level stuff, jumping straight to premarital, unprotected vaginal intercourse on the couch. So there's sort of a thing going on in the movie where Roy seems sort of sexually stunted somehow, which is hard to believe, actually, because the actor Maxwell Caulfield, who played Roy, was hot as shit when this movie was made. Like he's so hot that he's on the poster of the movie. Okay, the poster of the movie is literally this overhead shot of Maxwell Caulfield laying in a bed, shirtless, six-pack, tan, laying in a bed. Total sexy boy. And I don't know. I find it hard to believe that, like, Roy was sort of this sexually frustrated ever in his life, because he seems kind of gruff, but he doesn't seem like a guy who would be, you know, hard up for sex. But anytime some sort of, like, sexual situation comes around, he completely freaks out. He totally spazzes, like, you know, at the gay bar and now at Angie's apartment, you know, seeing Bo and her just straight up having sex on the couch. Also, when they were in the gay bar, like, I still find it hilarious that they had no idea that they were in a fucking gay bar. You know, it's just like, it's just nothing but dudes dancing with each other. Few women in there, but mostly dudes dancing with each other and dudes, like, making out. And they're just like, well, this bar is weird. So, I mean, naive for sure. But the movie is very good at explaining that, like, these guys aren't as cold and calculated as they seem. Like, they're pretty dumb, and you kind of get a sense of how unprepared and immature and dumb they are as the movie goes on. But they're also incredibly dangerous. So, I mean, dumb, dangerous people can do a lot of damage pretty quickly. Okay, so remember the couple he shot sitting in the convertible making out? Well, he shot them because Bo hit on some guy's girlfriend, and when he realizes she's all booed up with a boyfriend, he gets super butthurt, so Roy sees this as a slight on him somehow. So, hey, let's go stalk and kill these people. Same with Angie. Roy literally yanks Angie off of Bo's dick and throws her around the room and then picks her up and shakes her to death. Shakes her until her neck snaps. I mean, that's not really possible. I shouldn't have to tell you that that's really not possible unless you're, like, a baby, but yeah, he shakes her until her neck snaps. But as director Penelope Spears points out in the DVD commentary, Roy seems to kill out of boredom than anything else. And there's sort of, there's dialogue to sort of support that idea, because like a lot of his crimes seem premeditated, but it's really, there's always something going on where they're walking around, and I, you know what, I think it was right before they see the couple get into their convertible and head home. They're walking down the street and Bo's like, hey, what do you want to go do? And Roy's like, let's go see a movie. Bo's like, I didn't come all the way to LA to see a movie. So they're clearly bored. Like, they took this trip out of town and they're not really doing anything. They're just kind of just sort of hanging out, doing nothing. But yeah, that, I think that was an interesting thing to point out. Penelope Spears, just, he's killing out of boredom, which it kind of makes sense. You know what I mean? It's, there's not some grand plan or scheme, or, you know, there's not going to be a moment in the movie where he's like, oh, all the women in the world are awful and I have to lash out, or my mother never loved me, or my dad abused me. He's just a bored, dumb, violent person. And there's a lot of those people out there. Like, I like how blunt the movie is about that fact. And every time Roy freaks and kills somebody, Bo freaks out for the moment, but the next scene he's like hitting on another girl like nothing happened. Yeah, every time Roy loses his shit and murders somebody and they have to like flee the scene, it just goes to the next scene, and Bo's whole thing is like he has to hit on chicks constantly. So Bo's not necessarily, you know, he doesn't have that vicious murderer thing in him that Roy has, but he's definitely complicit, and he's definitely, I don't know, he has a little sense of what right and wrong is, but not that much. I should point out that the Angie character, played by Patty D. Urbanville, who in the same year, in 1985, she was in an episode of Miami Vice, one of my favorite shows of all time. She was in an episode called Back in the World, and she was actually dating Don Johnson at the time. So if you're a Miami Vice fan, you can go see the episode Back in the World and go see Patty Durbinville. So after killing Angie, Bo finally grows a spine, puts his foot down, and tells Roy, like, we're going home, we're getting in the car, and we're getting out of here, because shit's gone way too far, we're going home. So Roy just, he agrees. He's like, you're right, let's get the fuck out of here. They get back to the car, which is surrounded by cops. Cops see them, and then boom, they're being chased. They run. They run down this alley, they pull out a gun, they hijack a car that's driving by, and the chase is on. They're being chased by cops, and they get chased down to this closed mall. So it's nighttime, right? And the closed mall is in Culver City, California. And if you're a fan of the Josh Brolin vehicle Thrashing, I believe that mall is also in that movie. But anyways, but we need more movies in malls. Like Initiation with Daphne Zuniga. That takes place in a mall, you know. Or just other movies that just have a mall in it for a scene or two. It's great. Like The Legend of Billie Jean. And then big obvious ones like Mallrats and Dawn of the Dead. Like, I like a mall in a movie. It's just a, I like a big, dumb, brightly lit symbol of capitalism. It's wonderful. Also, violent, cruel, sadistic movies with a Cinnabon or a Foot Locker or, in this case, a See's Candy in the background. Which is where the ending of this movie takes place. So, but I'll get to that. So, after their harrowing car chase out to the mall, Bo and Roy ditch the car and they go hide inside the mall. There's like no one around, but there's doors open where they can like run inside. So they're running through this pretty much empty mall. And visually, it's a great place to end a film. Just sort of an uninhabited mall at night. Wonderful. Isn't the remake of Dawn of the Dead is also in a mall? There's another mall movie. So Shooter McGavin and the rest of the police surround the building at this point. They get to a point where they know there's cops everywhere and they might not be able to escape the mall. But Roy says, "Hey, Bo, give me the gun." And Roy's willing to shoot his way out of the mall. But Bo knows that there's no getting away this time. That if he gives Roy the gun and he tries to follow Roy out, they're probably going to get, you know, shot to death by a whole bunch of fucking police. So there's no getting away this time. Bo then turns the gun on Roy. And Roy is shocked by this. They're best friends, after all. Roy takes one step towards Bo. And Bo shoots him. Shoots Roy right in the heart. It's very sudden. It's very violent. And Roy drops dead in the glow of a See's candy store, which... I don't know. I'll have to check the credits. I don't know if they thank See's Candy for, like, we want to murder our antagonist in front of your store at the climax, the ending of our film. But yeah, Bo just gets shot in the heart in front of a See's Candy and gunshots in a completely deserted mall is a dead giveaway of where your location is. So, cops show up, they surround Bo standing over the body of his best friend, and Bo surrenders. And once he's handcuffed, Officer Shooter McGavin says, like, "Why did you kill your friend?" And Bo replies, "Because I had to." Put him down. He put him down like a rabid dog. So Bo knew that as long as he's with Roy and Roy's alive, he's not going to stop killing people. He's going to just keep going until, well, he goes to prison or he gets murdered. And in this case, he got murdered by his best friend. So that is the end of The Boys Next Door. And I recommend it. I recommend it a lot. It's a great movie. It's timeless in its execution. I think, you know, it's a type of movie where, you know, if you had someone remake it today, you know, like, hold on. Who directed Nightcrawler? Dan Gilroy. If Dan Gilroy directed a remake of The Boys Next Door, it would be amazing because it does kind of have a Nightcrawler feel to it, you know? What else does it kind of feel like? Kind of feels like Collateral a little bit, just sort of that, just kind of chaos in Los Angeles at night type of feel. And you wouldn't really have to change anything. You know, you just find two hot new young guys who's young that you can get. If you got Tom Holland and Timothy Chalamet to be Bo and Roy and just basically do the exact same movie, I think it would be great. I think modern audiences would really, really cling on to it and, you know, just keep it the same. Just keep it dark and don't pull any punches. And it's, you know, and it's, don't glamorize the violence. Like, the violence is awful, but it really makes the story powerful. But yeah, what else is good about it? The good soundtrack. They have songs from The Cramps and Iggy Pop and Great White, if you're into Great White, and other Penelope Spheres movies I can recommend is The Decline of Western Civilization, Part 1 and Part 2. The Boys Next Door is kind of in between Part 1 and Part 2. Part 2, Decline of Western Civilization. Part 2, The Metal Years. That came out a couple of years after The Boys Next Door. There's also Hollywood Vice Squad. That came out after The Boys Next Door. And obviously, you can check out Wayne's World. Everyone loves Wayne's World. That Wayne's World was my shit when that came out. I think I was in sixth grade when Wayne's World came out. Wonderful, wonderful film. What else about The Boys Next Door? Oh, you know, actor Crispin Glover, who I have featured on the show when I did my Trent Harris episode. Crispin Glover auditioned for the part of Bo, but he didn't get the part. Who else? And Nicolas Cage actually auditioned for the character of Roy. So we could have had a Crispin Glover and Nicolas Cage version of The Boys Next Door. That could have been pretty amazing, I think. But, I mean, Crispin Glover did all right. He went on to do Friday the 13th, The Final Chapter. He did Back to the Future, obviously. And then he did a little short film called The Orkley Kid. And that would ultimately go on to become what was known as the Beaver Trilogy. And if you haven't seen the Beaver Trilogy, I go into it in detail on episode 40 of Skeleton Factory. It's called The Secret Tapes of Trent Harris. And it's a very interesting film. It's basically three short films that are all smashed together to make one film. And they made a whole documentary about it called The Beaver Trilogy Part 4. And yeah, but that's a whole other, you know, that's a whole other rabbit hole you can go down if you'd like. And actor Charlie Sheen, well, I mean, after this movie, he went on to do all sorts of things, obviously. He went on, after The Boys Next Door, Charlie Sheen went on to anally rape Corey Haim with Crisco oil on the set of Lucas in 1986, the following year. Allegedly. Those aren't my words. This is according to Corey Feldman. He said that Charlie Sheen anally raped Corey Haim with Crisco oil between two trailers on the set of Lucas. You know, maybe he did, maybe he didn't. I don't know. I do know that Charlie Sheen did respond to these allegations and said they were ridiculous and not true. So, you know, who knows? Hey, Adam, what's the next film that we're going to talk about? The next film is Angst from 1993, directed by Gerald Cargill. It's an Austrian film, Angst, also known as Fear. Angst is based on the real-life crimes of Austrian murderer Werner Kniezek. And Werner Kniezek was a troubled child, and at the age of 16, he stabbed his mother and then fled to Germany, where he was caught. He served 2 years in a juvenile facility. After his release, he went on to shoot a 73-year-old woman at her house during a burglary, quote-unquote. For this crime, he spent 8.5 years in prison. It's touched on in the film that he initially pled insanity, saying that the alleged burglary wasn't a burglary at all, but an uncontrollable impulse that he had to kill. And this may be true, but his plea of insanity was, at the time, denied. And Austria at the time had a policy that was sort of touted as this good and humane policy to allow soon-to-be-released offenders out of prison several days early, or even several weeks. But they would basically be given this sort of like day pass that would be for, you know, several days. Like, here's a day pass, and you can go out and find work or make any other accommodations before you're actually really released. So go out, find a job, come back to prison, and then you'll finish up the rest of your sentence and we'll have you out in no time. Kind of a weird policy. It seems like, why not just let people out early? Which Kinesic was released early, but it's like, why not just let him out? Why let him out and then he has to come back to prison just to let him out again? I don't know. But during Werner Kinesic's 3-day pass he was given, within that 3 days, as soon as he got out, he immediately committed multiple murder. So Angst highlights the torture killing of the Altrier family in their home in the city of St. Pölten, which is in Austria. These murders took place 2 years before Angst was put into production. So as soon as this was in the papers, like, this movie was already rocking and rolling. So kind of an edgy move. Kind of reminds me of the movie The Secret Life, Jeffrey Dahmer. Because as soon as he got arrested, that movie was immediately put into production. But, I mean, it's kind of cheap and low, but it's low budget and it's not particularly well acted or anything. And it just kind of comes off as an exploitation film, but I do kind of like it. I did a review on it on an episode like many, many episodes ago, but still it begs the question, like, is this movie exploitative? And I'm not positive about that yet. I do love a challenging movie with a negative, awful, despicable character that you're connected to at the hip. You become part of the action. You become an accomplice in a way to this character's horrible deeds, whoever the character might be. So, you know, movies like, I don't know, Man Bites Dog, maybe Monster, Charlize Theron. I don't know. I only saw Monster once, but I kind of feel like that movie is kind of similar. What else? Like Bad Lieutenant, Jörg Bucherite's Schramm, William Lustig's Maniac, Fred Vogel's The August Underground, John McNaughton's Henry Portrait of a Serial Killer, Stanley Kubrick's A Clockwork Orange. Movies where you're just with this horrible killer person the whole time. Okay. You sort of give yourself permission to become victimized in a way by being part of the crimes, and you feel for the victims, but there's a morbid sort of voyeurism you can kind of quietly settle into because it's a movie, you know. Sometimes sometimes even you like the bad guy, you know. You fall for their charms just like their victims do. Some of these films, the killer gets away with it, and others, they're apprehended by the authorities or even killed, like in the case of The Boys Next Door. You actually get both. One of them gets killed, and the other one goes to prison. So the killer in Angst, who goes unnamed, but he's sometimes referred to as just simply K, the letter, but the killer's unnamed in the movie, so... And he really has almost no dialogue at all, but instead he has narration of his inner thoughts. And the narration sort of serves to flesh out how a person can somehow become this monster. Not so much why, but how someone becomes this monster. So once released from prison, he stops off at this like cafe, diner, gas station for a sausage. And his inner dialogue vaguely tells us his intentions, specifically of these two young women who are sitting at the counter across from him. And he's like eating his sausage like an animal gnawing at a carcass. And he's basically fantasizing immediately about killing somebody, but he opts out of bringing his fantasies to life, given that he's in a public setting and there's witnesses everywhere. So he leaves, and after this, he jumps into a taxi, and the narrator explains, how the driver, who's a blonde woman, looks a lot like his first girlfriend, and a real whore, as he described her. So he's just sitting in the back of this cab as it's going down the road. And he says that at the age of 14, a woman who was old enough to be his mother sort of lured him home and seduced him. And she was really into like BDSM, getting tied up and getting whipped and all this sort of thing. And he sort of became her sex slave. And who knows what else, you know. So all through the narration, he's sitting in the back seat of the cab, and he's like unlacing one of his boots, which means he's kind of leaned forward and he's kind of shifty eyed. And the cab driver kind of sees him in the rearview mirror, and he knows he's doing something, but isn't sure what the hell he's doing. But the implication being that he's going to take off one of his bootlaces and strangle the driver. But she suspects something, and suddenly she slams on the brakes and demands to know, like, what the hell are you doing? And he sort of panics, and he jumps out of the cab and runs off. And I just got to say, the Klaus Schulze score, the soundtrack, that's sort of an... behind, like in the background of this scene, is just like totally hypnotic. Klaus Schulze was in the band Tangerine Dream, and they do a lot of sort of electronic kind of synthesizer filled kind of soundscapes. Really good shit. And if you haven't heard Tangerine Dream, there's a ton of stuff out there, and Klaus Schulze has done a ton of stuff, but the soundtrack to this movie is great. And I'm actually eyeing a copy of it right now on eBay. So after I rewatched the movie, I was like, why don't I own that soundtrack? It's so good. Anyways, after this, he dips into this sort of like tree-lined neighborhood, and he's walking down the road, and he just randomly picks a house, and it's sort of a house that's sort of obscured from the road, right? And he breaks in after kind of scoping it out, and he waits. So night falls, and this sort of unnamed family arrives back at the house, clearly representing the Altrier family, which consists of the eldest son, who is the real son was named Walter. He was 26, and he was a wheelchair-bound paraplegic and was mentally handicapped, at least in the movie. I don't know about the real Walter Altrier. I don't really know. But in the movie, he seems mentally handicapped, and he's a paraplegic. So he's already at the house. So his mother and his sister show up in a car. His mother, in real life, her name was Gertrude. She was 55, and Gertrude's daughter, Walter's sister, Ingrid, and she was 24. So you got son in a wheelchair, you got mom, and then you got sister, adult sister. So their names were sort of changed for the film. They basically don't have names except for the daughter. So once the mother and the daughter, they get inside and they're kind of getting settled in for the night. But once the mother sees that there's a broken window in the house, she sees like glass on the floor, which is where the killer entered. He immediately leaps into action. He overpowering the entire family. He flips over the son's wheelchair. Son can't run. He can't get up. So he's just stuck on the floor. He grabs the daughter. In the movie, her character's name is Sylvia. Her name in real life was Ingrid, but in the movie, her name is Sylvia. She's really the only one that really has a name in the movie. So he ties Sylvia, the daughter, to a door handle, and he like gags and ties up the mother. So this scene also has some narration about how he was an illegitimate child. He was unloved by his mother. He was later sent off to live with his grandmother, a very religious woman who was really ashamed of him because he was an illegitimate bastard son. That was just sort of his status in the family. And to hide her shame, she sent him away to a convent to eventually become a priest. So out of sight, out of mind, and the boy will get some Jesus. That's kind of how, you know, the real life Werner Knesic's life was. Movie follows his life pretty closely. You know, they take a couple little detours creatively and whatnot, but for the most part, like, this is the actual account of, for the most part, of what Werner Knesic actually did to these people. So while there, he, at the convent, that is, he snuck off to a nearby barn because it was like a farm. This sort of a convent school for kids was on this like farm setting. And he talks about how he went into the barn one day and he just stabbed a pig, probably to death. And its squeals were so loud it alerted the nuns, who ran to see what was going on, caught him. And then he was later expelled from the convent, having to then be raised by a very physically abusive stepfather. So this is the narration he's telling while he's like frantically like tying up and gagging this family. So the calm voiceover during these scenes of violence coupled with the Klaus Schulze soundtrack is so intense. It's really just, it's intense, it's frenetic. And the way everything was shot was really inventive. I've seen some stuff on it, but basically a lot of the scenes have this sort of like weird, almost psychedelic funhouse mirror element to it. And what they did is when they shot it, they actually shot a lot of the scenes using mirrors, so that you can get these sort of like weird perspectives of the room and the characters as they're running around and doing stuff. And it's sometimes it's kind of nauseating, but it almost seems like this is what the inside of a psychopath's mind would be like during when a killer is doing his thing. It's really weird. This movie really kind of gets inside of the mind of what this guy is doing in real time. So during the next scene where the killer drowns the handicapped brother in a bathtub of water, he tells a story about when he ran away from his stepfather's house. And this is exactly what he says word for word. This is why he's drowning a paraplegic man in a bathtub of water. This is what he says. So I ran away from home. I slept in the park. There I observed a swan. First I strangled it, then cut off its head. It was expelled from the flock and didn't go back with them in the water. It lived all by itself in the corner of the park. It liked humans very much, but it was afraid of me. I imagine I was taking my revenge then. Whew. So much of the voiceover are from confessions from Werner Kniezek. So, wanting to next kill the mother, he wanted the mother to see her drowned son before he strangled her, and wanted the daughter to see him strangle the mother before he kills her. So he wanted his victims to be in a constant state of fear. This excited him. He wanted to see what was in store for them. This was part of his deal. He didn't just get enjoyment and excitement from killing people. He wanted the people to be terrified before they were killed. So, and these narrations really paint that picture of like how dangerous this guy really is. So even going as far as to, he went as far as to give the mother her medication to ensure that she's stays awake so that she can have the maximum amount of suffering before he ultimately decides to kill her. So there's a whole scene where that happens, but the mother died, and most likely from a heart attack, and this is while she was bound and gagged, so he didn't get a chance to kill her. So while all this is happening, the daughter, even with her hands bound behind her back, saw the opportunity to try to make an escape. So she escapes from the house, and before she even makes it to the yard, he chases her down, and he stabs her to death. It's very violent. Stabs her to death and even begins drinking her blood from her neck like a vampire. After this, he falls asleep. And some time goes by. He basically falls asleep. And it's presumed that he may have had sex with her corpse when he wakes up the next day, because he's on top of her with his pants sort of half down. But her dress isn't hiked up or anything like that. So we don't know if he had sex with the dead body or what exactly. But he basically woke up on top of a dead woman on the property of the house. So incredibly brutal. So he decides to leave, but his fantasy isn't over yet. He loads the family's bodies into the trunk of their car, stating that he had plans for their corpses. The scene of him putting the bodies in the trunk is so gruelingly long, especially the mom and the brother, because the daughter's killed outside. So he pulled the car up and threw her into the car. But the mom and the brother... So during this whole ordeal in the house, tons of windows get broken. So there's just glass everywhere in the house. So when he's dragging out the mom and the brother, he's just dragging them across the floor to get them outside into the car. There's just, he's just dragging them over broken glass. It's very, it gets in your brain for sure. And his plan was to find new victims and show them the corpses of the people he already killed before they die. And I guess his fantasy would just continue like that on and on and on. And he loads them into the car. He hastily washes himself off in the kitchen sink and finds what I assume are some of the son's clothes. So he's changing out of his bloody pants, but he keeps his just bloodied button-up shirt on. And then puts on, for some reason, there's a white tuxedo jacket with like with tails on hanging up. And he puts that on. And then once he's in the car, he puts on black leather gloves. So he just looks crazy, only less soiled in blood, but he still looks crazy. And then before he leaves, he scoops up the family's pet wiener dog that's been in the movie the whole time, just roaming around the house, and takes it with him, possibly to kill later. And he drives off back the same road that he came from, but he stops back at that same like diner gas station from the beginning of the movie. And all the same people are there for some reason, as if they never left. And as soon as he walks in, everyone's just staring at this dirty man in a white tuxedo jacket wearing black gloves who orders and starts frantically eating a sausage with his hands, wearing picture this, a man in black leather gloves dipping a sausage in mustard and just eating it in the middle of a shop with sort of blood washed off his face. Not a good look, and everyone in the diner is completely freaked out. So you know the feeling like when you go to like a coffee shop or you go to a store and all of a sudden, an unhinged homeless man is wandering around in the store, talking to himself, acting very suspicious. It's kind of like that. So then we cut to his inner monologue, which is sort of the scattered ramblings about killing everyone in the diner. Okay, he's feeling powerful after his night of killing this whole family, and he's like, I think I'm just gonna kill everyone in this diner right now. There's four people in there. Okay, there's the two girls from the day before, there's a kind of an older man sitting at a table reading the paper, and then there's sort of the diner waitress who's like an older woman. In his inner monologue, he's just sitting here just dead-eyed, just eating a sausage, and he's like, I think I'm just gonna kill everyone in this diner right now. But he takes his plate of sausage and mustard and his Kaiser roll and heads outside to where the car is parked, which you can see right outside the window, because the dog is in the car just barking away. So he goes out there, opens the door, and just starts feeding the dog some sausage. Now, the patrons of the diner all get up and sort of walk outside, curious, because they're just like, you know, they don't often see a fucking crazy man in their little town. So just then, the saddest looking police car pulls up. Every once in a while you're watching something and like you can tell they didn't have a budget for a police car, so they just sort of like ghetto rig like a 90s Dodge Neon. They paint it white and they just put the letters police on the side, and then they just like duct tape a fucking light to the top of it, and that's your cop car. That's what the cop car looked like that pulled up to this gas station. And I mean, I hoped Austrian cop cars weren't this cheap looking. So I Googled Austrian cop car, and two vehicles popped up in all of these images. One was a VW minivan that, you know, has the whole like cop decal, you know, painted up. Looks like a cop car, but it's a minivan. The other picture that I found was of a Porsche. So there's two types of vehicles, apparently, in Austria in terms of cop cars. There's a VW minivan and there's a Porsche. So anyways, that's not important right now. But cops show up. They encircle the car of this crazy man who's feeding a sausage to a little wiener dog. And they tell him, hey, you, like, get over here, open your trunk. So we get this great camera shot of the cop sort of like walking around the car. They're circling him like sharks, right? And, you know, he's like, oh, I don't know what's going on. This is not even my car, yada, yada, yada. And finally, we get this great crane shot sort of overlooking the car as he opens the trunk. Bystanders in the parking lot sort of looking on. And we don't see what's in the truck. Okay, we don't see what's inside. But we know what's inside. We don't need to see it. We've seen what has happened. And that's it. The movie ends. And that was Angst. And I like Angst a lot. I definitely recommend it. It's, I love the spooky, haunting soundtrack by Klaus Schulze. I actually have I got this few years ago. Cult Epics did a very nice release of Angst. It has, it's got interviews with Erwin Leder, who was, he played the killer in the movie. A really good interview with Gerald Cargill. He's being interviewed by Jord Bucherite, who he did the Necromantic movies. He did Schramm. He did Der Totskin. Yeah, a whole bunch of stuff in here. Like, really, really solid release. And Cult Epics is owned by a guy named Nico B, who I talked about on episode 54 of Skeleton Factory, an episode called Roz Williams, Death Rock, Sadomasochism, Suicide and Fascism, where I talk about the films Pig and 1334. So that was released on Cult Epics. So, well, that is it for me, guys. I hope you go check out The Boys Next Door and Angst. They're very violent. They're very challenging films, but I like them a lot. I think they're very well made, and I think they have pretty good rewatchability. So, before I get going, I should probably do some plugs. You can find me on Instagram at skeleton_factory. I'm also at Twitter at SFPodcastATX. And please support the show at Patreon at patreon.com/skeletonfactory. That's patreon.com/skeletonfactory. There's more shows over there for your listening and viewing pleasure. This is the Skeleton Factory Podcast, rescuing your movie night one movie at a time. I am Adam. I will catch you all in the next one. Bye-bye.